I'm fortunate to be joined by two very eminent experts, Linda Jacobson and Bonnie Glaser. Now, Linda Jacobson, many of you will know already, of course. She's an internationally recognised expert on China's foreign policy. She's a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Nowadays, she's an independent researcher who works part-time as a visiting professor at the United States Studies Centre at Sydney University. And last year, China co-founded Linda. Linda co-founded China Matters, a not-for-profit public policy initiative in Australia. Now, before Linda moved to Australia in 2010 to take up the position of the East Asia Program Director at the Lowy Institute, she lived and worked in China for 22 years and has published 6 books on China and other East Asian societies. Her latest publication is a Lowy Institute report on China's unpredictable maritime security actors, which came out late last year. Now, on my left, we have the eminent Bonnie Glaser. Now, Bonnie Glaser is a senior advisor at the highly respected and very well-known Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Before working there, Bonnie worked for several decades as a consultant for the U.S. government. Bonnie's written extensively on Chinese threat perceptions and views of the strategic environment, China's foreign policy, Sino-U.S. relations, U.S.-China military ties, cross-strait relations, China's assessments of the Korean Peninsula, and Chinese perspectives on missile defence and multilateral security. So evidently, we have a great depth of expertise here with us today. So how we're going to run things today is we're going to let Bonnie and Linda make some opening comments for about 10 minutes each. We'll have a bit of a discussion here, and then we'll open up to the floor for your questions as well. So I'd like to start, if you don't mind, with Bonnie.
Thank you, Meriden, and good afternoon to you all. What I think Meriden failed to say was that I'm now a non-resident fellow.
I did fail to say that, sorry.
At the Lowy Institute and spending 2 weeks here in Australia. So let me begin by talking a little bit about Xi Jinping. When he first came to power in November of 2012, he put forward a very clear strategic objective for the nation. And he labeled that the Chinese dream, the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Xi Jinping has in mind, I believe, a grand strategy to achieve this goal. His priorities are first and foremost domestic. He wants to strengthen the Chinese Communist Party, put the economy on sound footing, transition to a more consumption-driven economy. And, of course, the anti-corruption campaign is very much part of that agenda as well. But there is also an external component to the Chinese dream. Xi Jinping talks frequently about protecting Chinese core interests. And one of those core interests is sovereignty and territorial integrity and defending what China believes is rightfully belongs to China. So in the maritime spaces, I believe that China is very much dissatisfied with the status quo. It has not had capability until recently to begin to change these circumstances in China's favor. So China seeks to make the surrounding environment more favorable to Chinese interests. So in the East China Sea, we see China conducting patrols on a very routine basis, challenging Japanese administrative control over the disputed Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And in the South China Sea, we see China building these artificial islands, dredging, land reclamation activities. China's a latecomer in the South China Sea. By the time that China tried to get a presence in the South China Sea, all the good land features were taken. So China has these submerged reefs, a couple of rocks, and it's expanding them. And that will give it significant capability. Now, China wants to exert greater control over the activities in what the Chinese call its near seas. This is the South China Sea, East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea. And this includes controlling fishing activities that China objects to. The Chinese just declared today its annual fishing ban in certain areas of the South China Sea. Energy exploitation, where China has interfered, obstructed, in fact, some of the energy exploitation activities conducted by both the Philippines and Vietnam. And, of course, foreign military activities. The Chinese are using white hulled ships, that is, law enforcement ships, not military, to pursue what I call and others call a salami slicing strategy. So it's small incremental steps, none of which by itself is a casus belli, if you will. The Chinese really want to avoid provoking a military response from the United States. China does not, in my view, seek to supplant the United States as the dominant power in the region, or certainly not globally in the near term. But it does want to weaken U.S. alliances. China has long said that it sees alliances as Cold War relics. China wants to sow doubts in the region about U.S. reliability, and it prefers to deal with countries bilaterally, where, of course, it has far greater leverage without U.S. interference. And China's pursuing a strategy that relies very heavily on economic incentives. This is where China's strength is. So the One Belt, One Road initiative, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Silk Road Maritime Fund. So these are all examples where China intends to give economic carrots and in return get deference, if you will, from neighbors on the periphery. The maritime component of Xi Jinping's strategy is central, and at the 18th Party Congress, it was declared that China has an ambition to become a maritime power. And Xi Jinping plays a very key role in the implementation of this strategy. So he's head of the National Security Commission, the Foreign Affairs Leading Small Group, importantly, the Maritime Rights Leading Small Group that was created just before he came to power in 2012. He is intimately involved in decision-making. So in October of 2013, he led this periphery diplomacy work conference, the first of its kind in China, and he gave a very important speech. And if you read that speech, at least what was reported by Xinhua, you will get the impression that China is saying, and Xi Jinping was saying at the time, we want to get along with our neighbors. The periphery is very important to China. But if you read the internal version of this speech, if you can get hold of it, you will find out that Xi Jinping said something else. In fact, what he said was, we want to keep our neighbors off balance, and we want to use surprise. And it is against that background that some of China's moves make a lot of sense. In November 2013, China declared an air defense identification zone, an ADIZ, in the East China Sea. And in May of 2014, it deployed an oil rig off the coast of the Paracels, which China controls, but inside the 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone of Vietnam. So all of this, I think, is very much part of China's strategy. Now, not every action or every decision is approved of by Xi Jinping. And I can just give you one small example. The Chinese military, on occasion, does act in ways that are not approved at the highest levels. So there were a couple of incidents where the Chinese Navy aimed fire control radar at a Japanese helicopter and a Japanese frigate. I believe that that was the action taken by an individual operator, going beyond Xi Jinping's writ and being, I think, rather dangerous. And we just saw reported in the last week that in the South China Sea, the Chinese used, it was a frigate that shined a light six times at a Philippine military surveillance aircraft that was operating around one of these reclaimed artificial islands. Interesting, that particular island called Subi Reef was originally a natural submerged feature, which means, according to the convention, the law of the sea, it gets no territorial sea or airspace. So that is, in fact, a violation of freedom of navigation. So that's just one example. Linda, I know, is going to talk about and has written extensively about how there are various maritime actors who can act autonomously. But my argument is that the big decisions, the air defense identification zone, the oil rig, the land reclamation, the patrols in the East China Sea, these are decisions that are all made by Xi Jinping. They are part of Xi Jinping's grand strategy. They are supported by the vast majority of constituencies within China, including the general public. And they have helped to make Xi Jinping the most popular leader that China has had in decades, and they pose challenges to peace and security in the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very, really fascinating introduction. Thank you, Bonnie. Linda, I'll hand over to you to give your views about the different actors and what they're up to and Xi Jinping's grand strategy.
Thank you, Meriden. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Bonnie. Before we begin and talk about maritime security, I'd like to point out that Bonnie and I do come from different backgrounds, so obviously we have different perspectives. I think we are somewhat also representative of different schools of thought about the role of a think tank researcher. I think the Washington, D.C. think tank world is very, very different from a think tank world in Europe, from where I come originally. I'm not an American. I've been brought up in that country. I've lived in that country as a fellow at Harvard. But I'm also not Australian. I'm not Chinese, though I've lived in that country for 22 years. I'm very much a European in my thinking. And perhaps because of those quite unique two decades that I spent in China, I see my role as a researcher trying to examine what China is doing, interpreting China's actions and motives to the best of my ability in as nonpartisan, impartial way as possible. Now, that's often interpreted to mean that I am sticking up for China. I don't necessarily agree with what China is doing. I'm basically trying to interpret China on the basis of my own research and my experiences. My second point is one that we all know, but I think it's important to put on the table to remind us we know very little about Chinese decision-making. We know very little at the end of the day about how the very top policies are formulated, what is the process, what's in the mind of Xi Jinping. The system is still incredibly secretive. Say what you want about the American political system. It's become very popular nowadays to talk about the dysfunctionality of Washington, D.C. But it's an open system where you have a chance to discuss these very important issues with rather top policymakers. We, that means Bonnie, I, any researcher, we never in China sit and chat with the equivalent of an Asia director of the National Security Council, as I know Bonnie regularly talks with the American one. I do too when I go to Washington, D.C. Bonnie regularly has dinner with top officials and is able to discuss things that might be going on in Barack Obama's mind when he formulates China policy. We don't know what's going on in Xi Jinping's mind. So I think even though all officials obviously put a certain spin to things, we certainly know a lot more about Obama than we do about Xi Jinping. And then the third point, of course, to the topic of the day. Does China have a grand strategy? I think Bonnie and I agree on a lot of points. Many of the points she made today I agree on. And our disagreements, I think, are the following. How do you define the word grand strategy? What does it mean? I think at an aspirational level, China certainly would like to see the South China Sea its own sea. It's a point I make in a forthcoming Lowy Institute report that I'm co-authoring with Rory Medcalf. But we're not talking about aspirational here. If grand strategy means that they have an objective and they have sat down with Xi Jinping as the leader to plot out step one, step two, step three to achieve that strategic objective, I don't think that China has a grand strategy. I think the Chinese are much more practical. I think they're really pushing the envelope at the moment, testing the resolve of the United States. What Xi Jinping has done is he's given a lot more emphasis to China's need to staunchly, quote unquote, defend sovereignty while at the same time maintaining stability. Now, during his predecessor's time, it was all about maintaining stability. Now he said that both of these objectives are important, and I would say he's put even a little bit more emphasis on staunchly defending sovereignty, which then goes to these disputed islands and so on. As Bonnie said,
She cannot possibly make every decision that's made in China's name. In fact, he's now taken on so many responsibilities that one can wonder, can he possibly manage this? David Lampton, Mike Lampton, of Johns Hopkins has very recently come out with an article which very much is in line with my thinking. Number one, can he possibly fulfill the task as he sits on top of just about every pivotal decision-making committee or group? And second, which this is Mike Lampton saying, he's saying that Xi's attempt to sort of circumvent the normal channels of decision-making has thrust the foreign policy establishment in Beijing in disarray. And it remains, of course, to be seen what are the implications of that. For me, and I think I come out with this rather clearly in that report that Meriden mentioned, the Unpredictable Maritime Security Actors of China, for me, Xi Jinping is certainly a man who is very determined in what he wants to do. But China doesn't work in the way that one man gives orders and everyone is about to obey him. There are numerous maritime security actors, and it's in their interests. I fully agree with what Bonnie said. Most of Chinese elites today definitely support what Xi Jinping is doing. But these actors, they all have their own interests. It could be personal interests, but it also could be institutional interests. They want government funding, they want more prestige, they want more power within the system. So these actors are really pushing the envelope at times, using this rather ambiguous way of Xi Jinping expressing that we have to steadfastly defend sovereignty. And to promote their own interests, they are testing the limits of the permissible. And I'll stop there. I'm sure I have lots of other points we can discuss with Bonnie, but I want to give Bonnie a chance to respond. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I think it's interesting what you're saying about the different actors and their different incentives. Certainly when I was working in China, working with the Ministry of Commerce and some of the different agencies there, it's very evident in a day-to-day way how much they're not only different ministries have their own different interests and to what degree that constrains their behaviour, but even within ministries, different actors, different individuals have their own risk aversions, their own ambitions, and that can really change how a policy or an agreed course of action goes ahead. One woman that we were working with closely in the Ministry of Commerce, we had a great plan, we had an eight-step plan, it was going terrifically, and then all of a sudden everything froze and we wondered what was happening. What we realised after a while of months of trying to work it out was that her son was doing his high school exam. And while he was doing his high school exam, she was only focusing on making sure that he could do his high school exam. And it changed the whole notion, the whole relationship, the whole incentive structure. Everything we were able to achieve was stymied, more or less, for quite a long period of time by this individual. And you multiply that by all the individuals in the agencies and the agency's own interests, and I think you do see quite a lot of it happens in Australia, it happens everywhere, and it certainly happens in China, that the ministries are not always singing to the same tune. But I wanted to go back to this idea, if I could, about China, what it wants to achieve in the South China Sea particularly. We've talked a little bit that it wants to strengthen its position. We've mentioned that you were saying, Bonnie, that it wants to make the South China Sea its own.
I said that.
You said it wants to the preeminence in the South China Sea.
Aspirationally.
Aspirationally, right. So I wanted to know, do either of you have a strong feeling about what China wants to do with that? Because I think there's a lot of talk about how China wants to have this influence, wants to have more voice in the area. What does it want to do when it has that? Do you think China has a clear idea of what it wants to do with more voice, with preeminence, with having the South China Sea as its own kind of sea? Or is that as far as the vision has gone? Can I throw to you two first, Bonnie?
Well, I think you're asking two different questions. So if you focus aspirationally, what does China want to do in the entire region is quite different than the South China Sea. But the South China Sea is important to China, I think, first and foremost for nationalism reasons. These are areas where, as Xi Jinping has said repeatedly, that China will never suffer at the hands of foreign exploitation again, having land that is taken from China or not returned to China is increasingly what it's about, because the Chinese want to take some of this back. Although I don't think that they are going to use force to do so, but rather other means. But I think that importantly also is just controlling the activities that take place there. And as I said, it's about energy, it's about fishing. And in the military realm, it is about ensuring that ships do not operate in ways that are potential threats to China. So this is more broadly, really within the first island chain, what people refer to as this sort of broad swath of area that extends all the way down to the Philippines and Taiwan, and then northward beyond Japan, where China hopes that in a crisis, it will have the capability to prevent U.S. warships from operating there. So the United States refers to these capabilities anti-access area denial. They are missiles and fighters and submarines. China has been working very hard to ensure that it has the capabilities to put U.S. ships in jeopardy so that the U.S. will think twice before entering those waters. In peacetime, this doesn't have as much impact, but in a crisis, it would. So I think that militarily, people, some observers talk about China wanting to even use the South China Sea as a bastion for its nuclear submarines, much as the Soviet Union used the Sea of Okhotsk. We do not know yet if that is the case. But clearly, this is an area where China sees as traditionally within its purview, within its area of interest. And so I think that China's goal in the near to medium term is to increase its control over these activities over a longer period of time. But I don't think that China has ambitions, more generally, to supplant the United States as sort of this preeminent power in the region for a long time to come. If it has that ambition, I would agree with Linda that it doesn't have a blueprint for how to get there.
Linda, what are your thoughts?
And here, this is where Bonnie and I agree on just about everything. It's really just, that's why I said that I think the terminology is something that we're both now disagreeing on, because I agree with Bonnie, certainly I agree with Bonnie that China has rather ambitious regional ambitions. China is ambitious regionally, there's no doubt about that. It wants more and more control over the South China Sea, which it looks upon as its near sea. It doesn't have those global ambitions. I don't think it's trying in the near to midterm in any way push the United States out. One of the things I was criticized for after the report on maritime security actors came out was that I'm painting a picture that it's somehow chaotic, the decision-making in China. That was not my intent, and if that was the impression I created, then I, as the author, am responsible for it. I was simply trying to say that the Chinese system works in a very messy, uncoordinated way, and there are a huge number of interest groups, and the PLA I definitely see as one of them, wanting to push the envelope. This maritime consciousness, which has now become so important in China. Xi Jinping is using that very, very skillfully, nationalism generally speaking, and this rights consciousness. I mean, everywhere you apply for money, it's all about we have to defend our maritime periphery. And so I think interest groups are very savvy about that. But as far as the long-term goals, I mean, I would agree with what Bonnie said.
So, I mean, if China wants to have, perhaps not to supplant the US in the immediate future, but it wants to control, for example, as you said, energy, fishing, military, it's conjecture, I suppose, but do we have any signs at all of what China wants to do when it has more influence, when it has more control? Do we need to be as anxious about the normative system or the international the rules of the region
as we seem to be, do you think, Linda?
I've said that the biggest question of our era is that we do not know how China is going to use its power. That makes many countries, many peoples around the world anxious. To be very honest, it makes the Chinese people themselves anxious. There have now been indications, because China has used coercive methods to get what it wants, that is this the way China is going to use its power when it gets stronger? So for obvious reasons, people are anxious and worried. And I think that's rather logical. China, on the other hand, I was just in the United States at a workshop, and a researcher called Denny Roy, who's been writing about these issues for years, he says, is there any research which would prove that American national interests or economic prosperity would suffer from China being in charge of the South China Sea? Now, I'm not the right person to answer that, but I thought it was interesting that an American actually put that forward. But I'm turning to Bonnie.
Bonnie. 5 years ago, then Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi, when he was attending the ASEAN Regional Forum, after many of the representatives from, I think it was about 11 countries, spoke out and expressed concern about China's behavior in the South China Sea. The Chinese foreign minister looked at the foreign minister, I believe, from Singapore, as it was reported, and said, we're a large country. You are all small countries. So essentially, the message is China's interests take priority over those from smaller countries. And if you talk to diplomats from smaller countries, you will hear that privately, this is the tone that the Chinese take with many countries. They believe that they will use their economic largesse, the carrots, the incentives, the inducements to other countries. And in return, China expects that those countries, at a minimum, will not take steps that damage China's security interests. And I'll give you one example. So South Korea today is thinking about how to defend itself against a growing threat from North Korea's ballistic missiles. And the capabilities that it has are really not sufficient. And so there is discussion about how they might expand missile defense capabilities. And one of the options is for the United States to deploy theater high altitude defense, which is called THAAD. And the Chinese have been sending very high level officials, including the military, the Chinese defense minister, and very pointedly telling the South Koreans, you should not deploy that system because they believe that it will erode their nuclear deterrent. Now, we can get into whether or not that's actually the case, but that certainly is not the intention. The U.S. is not looking to erode China's deterrent. It's trying to help defend South Korea and American forces that are deployed on the peninsula. But the Chinese fully expect, you know, South Korea exports 40% of its goods and to China. So it's very dependent on the Chinese economy. And the Chinese do expect that in return, countries will not listen to everything that China says, but pay deference. And when China's security is at stake, that countries will take Chinese concerns into consideration.
Can I just add something? Yeah, I agree. I think we're going to see, if China's rise continues, and I always say if because we don't know, but if it does, there'll be more and more pressure on the smaller countries in Southeast Asia to take into consideration, quote-unquote, Chinese security concerns. But the other side of the coin, I just have to relate it, at this workshop at the East-West Center in D.C., where Denny Roy spoke about if China was in charge of the South China Sea, there was quite a few researchers from the Philippines who told us the Chinese continuously, nearly on a daily basis, are putting pressure on them, continuously putting pressure. You've got to take into consideration our core interests. But then in come the Americans, who put a lot of pressure on the Philippines that rebuff them. Hold your own, rebuff the Chinese. So they feel very squeezed. No one wants to take sides. I think it's not as black and white, though obviously we've seen a lot of Southeast Asian nations really go to the United States, want more defense cooperation with the United States. But it's not a black and white picture. Basically, they're feeling very squeezed, just generally speaking. There's a lot of pressure from American diplomats as well on some of these issues.
So I just want to jump in very, very briefly on that because I just met with Philippine Foreign Minister Del Rosario, who was in Washington last week, and I have regular conversations with the Philippines. And I believe that the Philippines' decision under President Aquino to stand up to China is truly his own. Mm. That the United States does not go to the Philippines and say, you should go sail your warship into Scarborough Shoal and go arrest those fishermen who are poaching, or stand up to the Chinese in other ways. I think, in fact, the United States has been taken by surprise at some of the things that the Philippines has done. It was indeed Manila that decided to file the case under ITLOS and the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and the Philippines asked the United States to provide backing, which we have said we supported, because there is no better way to address and potentially, of course, resolve these disputes than other than according to international law. But I wouldn't want to leave everybody with the impression that the United States is somehow insisting that the Philippines do something that they would consider contrary to their national interests. I think it's quite surprising to me how forceful the Philippines, a country with very little maritime and military capability, has been willing to stand up for its interests.
Do you feel that they're squeezed, many of the Southeast Asian countries? They feel because the United States can't possibly provide the prosperity that China is offering, they're going to have to continue this very delicate balancing act.
I agree with your perception. They all want to have good relations with China and with the United States, as everybody does here in Australia. But they don't feel squeezed because of an active effort by the United States to make them stand up to China. I would not put it that way. But I would underscore that from an American perspective, it is in the interests of the United States to have every country in the region get along with China.
It's interesting.
We are not looking to see countries somehow sacrifice their own interests, but we do want countries to have good relations with China, and frankly, the United States also would like to, where we have common ground and overlapping interests, also want to have a cooperative relationship with China.
It's interesting what you said, Bonnie. There's no better way to resolve these disputes than in international law. Now, obviously, China doesn't necessarily agree with that. And considering the disputes that are trying to be resolved are often with China, it looks like some of the other countries in the region are taking other routes, more behind the scenes, more diplomatic, less public displays of disagreement that may, we don't know, be successful. Do you think that the international law really is the best and only way to resolve these disputes with China?
Well, ultimately, I do think where you have sovereignty disputes, that the International Court of Justice is where these disputes should be taken to be addressed. China's not the only actor that doesn't want to do that. I don't think there's any claimant in the South China Sea that really wants to go to the ICJ. Diplomacy is very important in managing disputes. Probably cannot resolve them, but important in management. And there has been discussion in Southeast Asia and between ASEAN and China about what is called a code of conduct. So in 2002, when China and ASEAN signed the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the South China Sea, and one of the provisions was that a binding code of conduct would be negotiated down the road. And everybody was so relieved when that was signed, they put it on a shelf. China's behavior changed, and everybody thought, oh, no need to really implement this. It actually has some wonderful confidence-building measures included as well. And it wasn't until things started heating up again in 2009, 2010, that the ASEAN countries once again started to call for this code of conduct. China's finally agreed to begin negotiations, but everybody that I have talked to that has been involved in these discussions tells me that they are at best moving at a glacial pace. And particularly in light of the case that the Philippines has brought and the land reclamation activities, that I think the Chinese want to see the status quo change more in its favor before it is going to agree to anything binding. And at the end of the day, China might not agree to have a code of conduct be legally binding, and they might oppose the inclusion of a dispute settlement mechanism. And I would argue without those two elements, they might as well just stick with the original 2002 DOC, because it really won't help to manage the problem.
Okay, just very quickly following up on that. You said diplomacy is useful for managing but not necessarily solving. Now, in the past, as you've mentioned, China's resolved a lot of its land border disputes, 14 land borders, through bilateral negotiations and diplomacy. Why do you think that's not working now in maritime disputes?
It's a very, very important question. There's this wonderful book that Taylor Fravel up at MIT has written about China's negotiation of its land border. And at that time, China was weak. China really needed to have peace with its neighbors, and China had, a different leader. All of those things were relevant. China's capabilities were less. And in many of those disputes, the Chinese gave up land in these negotiations as they solved them. So I was told there's a secret agreement with North Korea that Chinese actually gave back some territory to the North Koreans. But those that are well known, of course, are the land border with Russia that was resolved. And so these were what we would call give and take. And if you're engaged in diplomacy and you can reach compromises, it becomes possible to do that. There was also no Chinese public opinion at that time. Deng Xiaoping could do whatever he wanted to. Today, Xi Jinping does face public opinion factors, and the public is very nationalistic and does not support compromise of any kind. So when they were negotiating these agreements in the past, the Chinese had this four-character expression with the land borders that meant mutual compromise and mutual understanding. That approach it's gone out the window. You know, this is not used to apply at all to any of these maritime disputes. And then, of course, you can get into the geographical factors. It's much easier to draw a line and monitor a land border than it is to resolve maritime disputes, which are much more complicated, and you have overlapping issues like exclusive economic zones and resources.
Right. I just make two comments. One of them is this whole question of will China ever accept an international court decision? I think it's very important to note that in the major speeches that Xi Jinping has made on foreign policy so far, three of them, he does not ground his vision of China's international relations in international law. This is something, actually, that a colleague of mine, when we had a China Matters youth event, Eva Odea, mentioned. She has been studying law and is a student of Chinese studies. I think this is something that other countries have to continuously take up with China. There wasn't any mention in any of his big speeches of international law and China wanting to abide by it. That's just one little addition to what Bonnie already said, which I agree with. The other one, this question of public opinion. It is true that nationalism at the moment does tie the hands of Chinese leaders. I think that's how I've written it. In a moment of crisis, especially if there's an international incident involving Japan, the United States, and so on. But, of course, the Chinese Communist Party has itself created this situation by continuously emphasizing this culture of national humiliation and the fact that it's only the Communist Party that is to thank for China having stood up. So by continuing this victimhood culture, obviously, citizens are very aware that outsiders are not to be trusted, and we should stand up now that we can, because China is no longer as weak as it was when it, for example, negotiated. the land boundaries. So it's a very, very difficult phenomenon, this thing with public opinion, because I always say that when they want to, and they have to, in the name of stability, if they're insecure, the leadership itself, they can turn that public opinion off. But when they let it flow, I would definitely agree with Bonnie, it is extremely nationalistic at the very grassroots level, though there are obviously lots of people who are not nationalistic in China, but just generally speaking.
Well, just before we hand over, we turn over to the audience for some Q&A, I just want to take it into the future. You've both got different views on whether or not China has a grand strategy, but then where does that leave us? Where does that leave us in terms of the implications of that, the policy responses that have been undertaken so far? What's going right? What should be being done differently? Where should we go from here? Bonnie, I'd like to start with you.
My view is that it is important to influence Chinese decision-making and shape its choices. So if the Chinese see no negative consequence of doing things one way, then they will choose to do what serves what I believe is China's selfish interests. I don't think that the Chinese have enough of a sort of global sense of responsibility, let alone regional sense of responsibility. But then the question is how you best do that, and you must make these decisions on a case-by-case basis. So if we look, for example, at the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, there was a discussion between the U.S. and Australia, as well as other countries, about how best to do that. And I think at the end of the day, the answer there was that by joining, by participating, then you are actually at the table and you can influence how China does things so that global governance will be handled well. In the maritime realm, I believe there has to be some costs imposed on China so that the Chinese know that they cannot coerce and intimidate smaller countries with impunity, which is really what is going on today. And so there are discussions in the United States about possibly expanding our freedom of navigation program to include some of these spaces around these artificial islands where China should not have a 12-mile territorial sea or airspace. And then there are other discussions that are going on about whether Navy ships, what we call gray hulls, should be used against white hulls. Again, the Chinese have created this space where they can do a great deal because they don't use their military. The U.S. Doesn't have Coast Guard ships deployed in that part of the West Pacific, and the countries that do have Coast Guard or law enforcement vessels, their capabilities pale by comparison, the most important, of course, being Japan. And they have their hands full just defending the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. So I think we do have to shape China's choices. We have to influence them. We have to equally have positive incentives for behavior, not just negative. But at the end of the day, I think that we all want to see China emerge as a nation that will use its power for the global good, provide more public goods for the region, and contribute to regional and global stability rather than detract from it.
Thank you.
I definitely think that the situation today is more tense in the South China Sea than it was a year ago, so I do worry more today than a year ago about an incident or an accident, and once it happens, we won't know whether it was intentional or not. I think it's a real balancing act also for Washington, D.C., when you take into consideration all the issues on which China and the United States are working together in a positive, constructive way, not to let the South China Sea so-called hijack the relationship. I think that's a real diplomatic challenge for Washington. I'm sure it is also for Beijing. I say this just as an analyst. I have no proof of it, but I'm sure they find it challenging it as well, because China needs the United States. China needs a constructive relationship with the United States. So, but I do worry about that incident getting closer and closer to reality with all the things that are going on. China pushing, the United States contemplating how to push back. But I'd like to end on a slightly more positive note and put forward something that I learned a couple of weeks ago in D.C. Chaz Freeman put forward a suggestion of how to move forward with the Southeast Asian countries and China, because as Bonnie said, I mean, though China has agreed to talks, they're moving at less than a snail's pace at the moment. All claimants would, according to this suggestion, freeze what they have is theirs. Obviously, China has less than others because, as Bonnie mentioned, it was a latecomer in the game. But everyone would agree that what islands or reefs or shoals they have, that remains theirs, and stop arguing. If all the other Southeast Asia claimants would agree to this, it would put pressure on China, in my view, to at least come to the table and be more proactive in discussing this, because it would be a coherent stance from the Southeast Asian other claimants. One of the problems that we haven't got into and we haven't had time to is that they themselves don't agree on these issues among themselves. I think the way to deal with China, at least in the South China Sea, is that the claimants would have a more united front. And this is the frustration of Australian diplomats who say, why should we put our skin in the game when not even the Southeast Asians will put their skin in the game? Or the American diplomats, and so on. So I'll end on a hopeful note.
Thank you. All right, so I'd like to open up to the audience for questions. But I would like to offer the first comment or question to our Lowy Institute's new International Security Program Director, who has just started with us this week, Mr. Ewan Graham. Dr. Ewan Graham, I beg your pardon, just down the front here.
Thank you, Meriden. Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Linda. My immediate takeaway from that was actually I was expecting there to be a bit more blue water between you, but I found you surprisingly in agreement on many things. Maybe the difference is actually more towards the levels of analysis rather than on substance. I'd like to do something obvious, which is just to point out the sort of differences between these two seas, which I guess implicitly have been put in a kind of uniform ranking, the East China Sea and the South China Sea. The South China Sea is much bigger, for starters. It contains deep water, which you alluded to with the potential bastion strategy for the Chinese Navy. The distribution of resources is also quite different. There's a lot more energy around the South China Sea. It's probably not in the middle. It's probably around the edge, which has significant bearing for the territorial disputes, which probably are not so energy rich as is often framed. And the question I'd like to put to you is, what's the internal relationship between the East China Sea and the South China Sea within China's overall maritime strategic approach? Maybe the answer one would expect, if one follows Linda's line of analysis, is that there might actually be more variation, or that the priority accorded to one might flip from one to another, depending on which maritime actor has the ascendance at any one given time. Maybe, Bonnie, you might see something more less changing in that, maybe something more enduring based on strategic ranking that is given to that particular body of water. You mentioned the South China Sea having that potential military function. I think it's also, for my money, more important in energy terms. And maybe one thing where I would just make a sort of side comment is on the nationalism factor, where I see the East China Sea clearly does have that priority because of the Japan-China relationship. I've always thought that the nationalism that's projected towards the South China Sea claims has more of a manufactured air to me, given the very small size of the holdings involved. That may change now, actually, given all the political capital that has been invested in by Xi Jinping, and that might be a sort of self-fulfilling cyclical phenomenon. But just to separate out that, the simple questions: what's the relationship between the East China Sea and the South China Sea within China's approach, and does the priority accorded to one vary over time, or is it constant?
Quickly start with you, Linda.
Very briefly, thank you so much for that question. We have sort of concentrated here on the South China Sea. I think East China Sea, like you said, a very different kind of sea for all the reasons that you mentioned. I think Xi Jinping has made it extremely clear, because obviously Japan is a formidable military force in its own right. It has the backing, very clearly stated, of the United States, that he does not want to see an incident in the East China Sea. There's also not so many actors. There's also not as much room for any maritime security actors within China to take advantage of that situation. So I think we are going to see a much more disciplined approach by China in the East China Sea, where there's less room for actors to maneuver than in the South China Sea. And I just would like to comment on what you said about the nationalism. I agree with you. I always thought that it was more manufactured on the South China Sea. But because it has gained prominence, like you said, I think people have now kind of included it on the radar screen. But Japan still is the number one kind of, if you press the button, Japan will ignite that nationalist kind of undercurrent.
Thank you, Linda. Bonnie.
On the issue of China's overall approach to Japan and dealing with the disputes in the East China Sea, I have seen a significant change in the way China is dealing with the Japanese, because their approach of putting a lot of pressure on Japan really has not succeeded. The Japanese haven't budged on the issue of administrative control or acknowledging that a dispute exists, which is what China sought. And the new and Japanese investment in China has been declining, and so I wrote a blog post you can read on the Lowy Interpreter on this issue. But in terms of the importance of the East China Sea, I tend to look at this in military strategic terms. Again, this is part of the, it's within the first island chain. And if you look at a map, if you are sitting in China and you look out over the eastern horizon, what you see are the Japanese islands that are blocking potential Chinese egress in a crisis. And so the Chinese want to ensure that they will have access to the Western Pacific in a crisis. And they want to ensure that Japan does not use these disputed islands for any military purposes. So I think that that really is their main concern. In the South China Sea, I think there are also issues of preventing foreign military vessels from sailing in a crisis. There is the possibility of threats to the sea lanes of communication, which I think the Chinese have always been worried about when it comes to access to energy that comes in from the sea. One of the reasons why the Chinese have tried to diversify and find land sources overland where they would receive energy. And I would certainly agree with Linda. I think the nationalism issue has really changed on the South China Sea. But it was originally very much sort of anti-Japan, and there is no sentiment in China that's particularly or as vehemently, you know, anti any particular Southeast Asian country. That's for sure. Japan, in that sense, is in a class by itself.
All right, so we'll hand over to the audience. I might get a couple of questions in a round, since I know that we're running out of time, unfortunately. So the gentleman in the front, please. And if we could just identify yourself at the beginning of the question and keep the questions quite to the point, and we'll keep our answers to the point as well.
Thank you. I'm Klaus, a PhD student from Sydney University. And from today's discussion, I have an impression that China's assertiveness is basically proportional to its capability. But looking back to China's use of power throughout the history, let's say from the 1974 Battle of Paracels to the 2012 Scarborough Shoal incident, in your perspective, don't you think that China's intensity of using military power in defending its claim is actually decreasing?
Okay, we'll get another couple of questions and then we'll turn to answers. Other questions from the audience? Have we fully resolved the issue for you in a completely satisfactory fashion? Everything sorted? Yes, sir.
Ian Crawford, a retired sailor and a guest of Geoffrey White. I'm sure all players in South China Sea and East China Sea recognise the risks to peace and stability of confrontation and the scope for it to escalate. Now, we don't have too much confidence if we look back 100 years and what happened in Europe about the recognition of the dangers of relation. It just did happen. But does sovereignty get in the way of the scope for a cooperative approach? Can the players, that is all the players, recognise the importance of peace and stability, the access to the sea lines of communication, to set aside or leave aside for the moment sovereignty, to allow cooperative exploitation of the resources? Who could influence that sort of outcome? Are we going to leave it to the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank to do it? Who could influence that sort of outcome?
Thank you. And one more question for this round.
Hi, I'm Paul Marriage. I just wondered if there's any link at all between the China's agenda in the South China Sea and East China Sea and its foreign policy agenda for Taiwan.
All right, thanks. We'll just take those three questions for the time being at least. Who would like to start? Linda?
Can sovereignty be left aside? I think I'm going to leave the first question to Bonnie about power and capability. I think that China is very much thinking that as its economic power over these countries grow, as the economic dependence on these countries, dependence on China grows, they'll be able to more and more convince, persuade, pressure, whichever word you want to use, coerce, some people would say, them to understand China's take on some of the sovereignty issues. I think China certainly is looking very kind of long-term at these issues. China needs peace and stability just as much as every other country, like you pointed out, in the region. So as long as we don't see an incident which spirals out of control and spirals out of control before the national leaders on both sides can sort of take control of the crisis, I think we will at some point see co-development. But it's difficult to see how we're ever going to get there because at the moment there are so many tensions among the different claimants. But certainly I think that's what China is banking on, that through these economic initiatives, the dependency of many of the Southeast Asian nations will just simply grow so large that they'll be able to co-develop on Chinese terms. That's my kind of realist thoughts.
So on the first question, I think it's very important that China is not relying, as I think I said in my opening remarks, on the use of military means in order to change status quo in its favor. In 1974, I would say China had a military advantage, also had no other real cards to play. Today, the Chinese have a bigger toolbox. It has, you know, economic incentives. It has a law enforcement capability, very large numbers of ships. And it has diplomacy that it uses. And so the Chinese really don't necessarily need to use military means and recognize that if they do, they will likely forge this anti-China coalition against them. And that will undermine China's ability to achieve this Chinese dream. So I think absolutely China is relying less on use of military force. Secondly, there's an enormous amount of cooperation in these waters between and among the claimants and also non-claimants. We can talk about scientific, marine cooperation, anti-piracy, and there are several very successful examples of energy exploitation, but they do not include China. The Chinese want to engage in exploitation in disputed areas. This was the problem with Vietnam and the deployment of the oil rig. As I understand it, the Vietnamese have said, we will consider joint exploitation, but not in our waters inside our EEZ.
And it's hard to find other areas. And Ewan correctly pointed out that it is believed that all of these energy resources are, they hug the coastlines, and so they are part of countries' EEZ. The one exception really is Reed Bank, and so it will be interesting to see whether there was an agreement between China and the Philippines, and Vietnam was part of that agreement, and now that has essentially been set aside. And then finally, the implications for Taiwan. And there are several. You know, Taiwan is a claimant in both the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And under Ma Ying-jeou, who has been in power now for over 7 years in Taiwan, he has tried to improve that cross-strait relationship and has made great progress in doing so. This issue of these maritime disputes, I think, has made it challenging because he does not want to side with Beijing in handling these disputes. So that's one of the implications. There will be an election in Taiwan in January. If the opposition returns to power, then the issue will change, I think, fairly fundamentally. But Taiwan, I think, doesn't. It wants to defend its own interests and wants to be part of these conversations on possibly creating a code of conduct. But Taiwan has been excluded. And so if there's ever any agreement, Taiwan's interests will be affected, but it is unlikely to be part of that decision-making process.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry we're going to have to wrap it up there. Our time is up. Thank you again for coming to the Lowy Institute. And please join me in thanking very much Bonnie Glaser and Linda Jacobson for joining us today.